I had actually reached out to the chief product officer at Whoop just to better understand if there was a collaboration opportunity between Swim.com and Whoop. And that conversation just, you know, one thing led to another, and I was hired as their first director of product. Product managers need to do more than just build a feature and launch it. And in fact, at Google, like, we have a concept where we differentiate the difference between launching and landing a feature. And for launching just means that it's exposed, but landing means that you've actually deployed it into the marketplace and you've had an impact.
I've been to one event of Super League, and I was looking at the triathletes running with their heart rate on the screen and their speed and all of that. And it was so fascinating because it was also giving me the idea that the sport is changing.
If I'm sitting in the stands and I'm watching a NASCAR race, the things that I'm seeing are like really exciting in terms of like what a race car race means. What I don't have any appreciation for is what the driver is going through. And so Whoop Live provided that kind of insight. I mean, there's really no question in my mind that the world we live in today, and certainly the world we're going to be living in going forward, is going to be one where there's more sensors, not less sensors. I do not believe in a world in which there's going to be a single device that's going to be able to capture everything all the time.
Great. John, it's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
I wanted to have this discussion, and you spent a number of years into the space. You're very, very experienced about what's happening with wearables. You spent time in teams like Whoop and Google and SuperCBNs. So wanted to have this discussion and share some insights with the listeners of this podcast. Why don't we start with a small introduction about yourself?
Yeah, sounds good. And thanks for the opportunity to talk. It's good to reconnect with you again. Happy to be here. Yeah, I think about my career, if we want to call it that, kind of in two big blocks. I have a background in biology and computer science and engineering, and spent the first half of my career in pharma, biotech, and financial services. And then the second half, or the last sort of 15 years, I've been in the startup space, largely focused on health and fitness. There was a catalyst that supported the transition between those two sort of opportunities. I was running an innovation lab for a major financial services company, and we were looking at the use of sensor technologies to enable new business models. So really, it was really around understanding, measuring, and mitigating risk on behalf of our, you know, customers. That exposed me to really kind of the raw power of sensors in general, and motion sensors specifically. And so from that, at the time I was training for triathlons, and we of course have like power meters for bikes and GPS for running, but there was nothing for swimming. So we built, myself and our co-founder built the first AI-based swim watch that was, you know, this was 2009 time period. So it wasn't a smartwatch, and it really wasn't a watch. So we'll call it a swim tracker. But that was my introduction into really product management and my first startup. And then from there, we sold that, which eventually spawned swim.com. And I did another startup. I was racing bikes and doing crit races and bike and road races, and apparently was crashing more than anybody was comfortable with, including me. So we built the first automatic ride tracking and crash detection device called Bike Tag. That really kicked off like my focus on health and fitness and, you know, getting into opportunities like Whoop, Super Sapiens, and eventually, you know, being the product leader for Android Health as well.
Can you speak a bit more about the AI sensor you mentioned?
Yeah. Yeah. So, like I said, this is around 2009, 2010. The Apple iPod and the API had just become available. So we had access to sensor technologies through, like, we didn't have to go find a manufacturer. We didn't have to build our own piece of hardware. We could just write software in order to access the technology to prove that you could use motion sensors, specifically accelerometers in this case, to track the movement of a swimmer and then come up with, you know, or derive metrics like how far you swam, what your stroke rate was, what stroke type you were swimming, so freestyle, breaststroke, butterfly, et cetera. And so we actually built this prototype. We would like vacuum seal an iPod touch to the outside of your arm and swim with it. And we took this prototype to a company called Finis, who we ultimately executed a joint venture with, built the SwimSense product. So this became our dedicated swim tracker, proprietary piece of hardware we built from ground up, and brought that to market. So the AI component really came down to, you had a lot of signal processing, right? That had to be done in order to like turn motion data into swimming metrics. And a part of that was using machine learning to classify things like turns and stroke types. And we were the first device in the market to be fully automatic, meaning you didn't have to press any buttons when you stopped swimming. So if I gave you a swimming set, like 10 by 100s on 145 or with a 10-second rest, for example, at that point in time, first of all, there weren't a lot of swim tracking solutions in general. But at that point in time, when you stopped swimming, you'd have to press a button to pause it, you'd rest, and then you'd press a button again in order to start swimming, right? And so you're demarcating your intervals manually, just like you would if you're like running on a track. But that's like really problematic for swimmers, right? Because like you're swimming, you're coming to the wall, your arm has to like reach over, hit the button as soon as possible because you want the most accurate timing. So we used a combination of signal processing and machine learning to automatically detect when a swimmer was swimming versus when they were resting. And actually today, I'm probably biased, but I do swim with as many devices as I possibly can at all times. I still think the SwimSense algorithms we built, and they've gone through multiple generations, which are now embedded in swim.com, like I mentioned earlier. And you can download that on like an Apple Watch and any Wear OS watch, has roughly speaking a plus or minus 1 second accuracy on interval detection. Which is a really hard problem, right? Because there's just so much noise happening from a motion perspective at the end of the wrist in a swimming environment.
Can we speak a bit more about that? Because I believe it's very difficult to measure the accurately, even if it's a track for a runner and so on. Is this a sensor problem or is this a software problem?
That's a good question. I mean, we tackled it as a software problem, right? So we leverage existing sensors. And I had mentioned before that we predominantly, in fact, exclusively used an accelerometer. Though a full IMU, like with a gyroscope, a magnetometer, an accelerometer, would certainly provide a lot more robust signaling, which would ultimately either reduce the software problem that you have or improve accuracy, or even unlock new features, which we could talk about. There's I think, a whole host of things we could be doing from a swim tracking perspective if you have full nine-DOF sensing capabilities. But for us, you know, we weren't looking to innovate on the hardware side as, you know, in that startup. And most aren't. I mean, even if you look at like Garmin, for example, or Shunto, Apple Watch, most of them, I would assume, based off of the capabilities that we see today from a swim tracking perspective, are probably just using the accelerometer. Maybe they're, you've got Apple today can also detect kicks. So if I had to guess, though, I don't know, that would be a combination of using like a magnetometer as well as an accelerometer. But most of it is a software problem, right? And it starts with like a signal processing problem, right? Like a classic signal processing problem and, signal filtering. In order to remove all the noise that is not important for ultimately deriving metrics like stroke count and stroke rate and distance swum and the type of stroke that you're swimming. I think there are very specific approaches you can take that where machine learning comes into play. Stroke type classification, like I had mentioned, is like a great fit for a traditional classification problem. Stroke identification. Right now, this gets a little bit into the weeds, but if you think about like what a swim looks like in a pool, you would see, let's say you started swimming, you would see, you kick off the wall and then you'd see stroke, 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 some number of strokes, and we won't even talk about the type of stroke yet. And then we'll see a gap, like something different than strokes, and then we see more strokes. And so you can begin to imagine how you could apply machine learning to identify patterns of swimming versus patterns of resting. And if you combine that with a set of heuristics and good signal processing, like we talked about, like all of this is very capable on existing hardware today.
Very interesting. When did you join Whoop? How early was it for the company?
I'd have to look at the exact year. I think it was like somewhere around 2019 or 2020, somewhere in that time period. It was right before COVID. I do know that. I was running swim.com at the time, and was also a user of Whoop, not just personally and still a user of Whoop. But some of the athletes who I was coaching, and also some of the athletes that my son is a professional triathlete that the team he was on was using Whoop as well. So I was introduced to Whoop through a variety of different lenses, including just professionally, like looking at the wearable space. I had actually reached out to the chief product officer at Whoop, just to better understand if there was a collaboration opportunity between swim.com and Whoop and the world of swimming. And that conversation just led to, one thing led to another. And I was hired as their first director of product.
I believe from very early on, Whoop had a very strong interest from athletes, like a lot of athletes. And I've seen a podcast lately mentioning that LeBron was one of the first 100 owners of a Whoop device. Mm. What did they do well early on and so many people? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, I wasn't there when it was launched, obviously, and wasn't there for like the initial growth, during the initial growth period of Whoop, but it's a big part of their story. And one of those pieces is that somebody at Whoop could probably get this more accurate than I can, but I don't believe Whoop ever sponsored any of those athletes, at least in the early days, when we saw Whoop coming onto the scene, right? And I think that's actually really interesting. Like, there's some important lessons to be learned from a product development point of view there, which is being product-led versus maybe marketing-led. And I don't mean to say that, like, being marketing-focused is the wrong thing by any means. But Whoop was very focused on solving a very particular problem. And in the early days, that was around building a sensor that could accurately capture heart rate variability and then deploy that metric within context so that it became useful for users. And that razor-sharp focus is really like became the bedrock for how we understand Whoop today. And their focus on the product and building a product that was both usable and, from a form factor perspective, from a battery life perspective, from a, building context around physiological metrics like heart rate variability, you could argue that was their primary focus. Versus, for example, we know there are other companies who maybe would take more of a marketing approach, really lean heavily on building the brand and the marketing. And then maybe, in some cases that dilutes the product opportunity, right? And we see that play out in like retention metrics, right? Or like customer lifetime value, metric. So I think Whoop got it right in the sense that they were focused on the product first and then, focused on growth and marketing, perhaps secondarily to that. And you saw a lot of organic usage as a result of that coming from these professional, folks in sports.
And you mentioned joining as first director of product. How many people were there when you joined? And what was your first kind of role there, or maybe product that you worked on?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, so when we launched Whoop 4.0, all employees got a special edition Whoop. And so, one of the things Whoop did when you joined, and they may still do this, is you get an employee number and you get a fair amount of swag that has your employee number on it. So on my Whoop device here, you can't see it, but has my employee number, which was 569. So to answer your question specifically, I was the 569th employee. So Yeah, I was the first director of product. I worked for Ben Foster. Ben, you know, is prolific in the product management space. Just really like an amazing opportunity for me to be mentored by somebody who is so experienced around vision-led product development. So I was excited not only about the opportunity to work for Whoop and for a product that I believed in, but, you know, the opportunity to work with Ben specifically was just a step function opportunity for me in my own growth. When I first joined Whoop, we were organized and sort of continued to organize in this sort of Spotify pod fashion where product managers and their teams were really focused on like functional capabilities. You could roughly, you know, at that time, we were roughly organized by sleep, strain, and recovery. It was more complicated than that, but those were kind of the functional focus areas. Most of my focus actually cut across those areas. So it was more foundational. So connectivity, Bluetooth connectivity was an area of focus. This is something that is, you know, we kind of hope that members didn't think about, right? But we knew at the time, and I'm sure still is the case, even beyond Whoop, where when users have connectivity issues, like, you know, the pairing with your phone gets dropped, there's just a very measurable amount of user friction and a destructive user experience that gets invoked there that has a long-term impact on things like user retention. So, you know, making sure that connection to your phone was seamless, robust, could automatically recover, like when you were not within the context of your phone, all of those things were really important for us to get right. Also, the membership services chat component that is in the app, that entire experience, my team owned. Developer API and connectivity, developer API and ecosystem we own. So building a robust API for developers to come in. I mean, you know this space well. And then there's also some features that just didn't fit very well within the structure that we have. So like Whoop Live, for example, which was, you know, didn't get the same attention as like strain and sleep and recovery, but that also fell into my remit.
Very interesting. So speaking of connectivity, a few years ago, I had a Polar device. And although I loved the device, it was impossible to connect it to my phone. Basically, I needed to initiate the sync process. Sometimes it would find my phone, sometimes it wouldn't. And it was a pretty big mess. So although Polar was awesome in terms of the hardware and the measurement of data, it was not good at all at connectivity. Then I've noticed that Garmin, by owning a Garmin, it's a much better experience, but I wouldn't say that it's as frictionless as Whoop. Whoop did a fantastic job at that. So can we speak a bit about the complexity of this and can we get into a bit more detail?
Yeah. I mean, I would underscore, like, your experience there is exactly the kind of destructive experience that we could measure its impact in terms of retention, right? Now, we probably need to step back for a second here because one of the things that's unique about Whoop is their business model, right? It's really like hardware as a service, if you will. And so with a membership model, if let's say that you have a 12-month membership and then you start to have these destructive user experiences, then we could actually look at the number of times that you had a disconnect event or that you had to repair your Whoop with your phone and predict if you were going to churn or not, right? But here's the thing. We wouldn't actually see if you churned or not until the renewal period happened. So in some ways, your negative experience today meant that we had a business impact, you know, 6, 7, 12 months down the road, depending upon when the renewal was. So that just like that was an implication that we had to pay attention to in terms of, you know, being on the right side of retention. One of the things that makes the pairing process difficult, I think on all devices, right? Like, you know, It is sort of surprising, unfortunately, but is the case that today that Bluetooth as a technology is still not as reliable as like flipping a switch on your wall, right? And getting like your lights to turn on, which is really what we all want it to be. But the average user who has to deal with all these devices, maybe we'll get into this, but like, well, I think we're going to see more and more sensor technologies be deployed on an individual and around an individual. So I don't see the ecosystem getting, simpler. I see it getting more complex, which is going to put more pressure on things like having robust, reliable auto-healing connections between these devices. So in Whoop specifically, in order to repair it, if you get yourself into like a really bad state, you need to take the device off. So already this is not the kind, Whoop has designed a product that you can leave on your wrist, for example, 100% of the time, right? You can even charge it on your wrist, which is like part of the magic of their industrial design and such. But then I need to go through this process of like tapping it and getting into a pairing mode. Maybe on my phone, I have to forget the Bluetooth connection, right? And then go through a complete repairing process. And you and I may be able to go through that fairly easily, even though it may be frustrating to have to do it. But we have a pretty good understanding of how the technology is working. Well, most users don't really want to deal with it and maybe don't understand like how the Bluetooth handshaking is working and the fact that they have to go in and like completely forget, the bonded pair between the two devices and start over. So, that kind of frustration can lead to just putting the device down, moving on, and not renewing the subscription. So like fundamentally getting those core capabilities right is super important. And if you don't, obviously then all the great innovation you're building on top of it, it doesn't matter, right? Because you have a device that actually is frustrating users and they can't even access those higher order features.
How do you tactically measure these things? I'm guessing you have a number of events happening, but then how do you, do you have some sort of CRM that you create funnels, or how do you tactically do that?
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, non-technically, it starts with, in my opinion, product managers who are interested in more than just building features. This maybe is an entirely different, discussion, right? But it's important, and this was, really valued at Whoop. It's also something that is really valued at Google, which I can talk about as well. But the idea is that product managers really, need to do more than just build a feature and launch it, right? And in fact, at Google, we have a concept where we differentiate the difference between launching and landing a feature, right? And so launching just means that it's exposed, but landing means that you've actually deployed it into the marketplace and you've had an impact that is aligned with the impact you thought you were going to have, even if you had to adjust what those KPIs and that impact look like along the way. And really the point is that you own it end to end. And so that mindset from a product management perspective means that you need to make sure you have the right instrumentation in place, right? And so when we look at the pairing flow on Whoop, well, making sure that we have telemetry built into all of the screens, all of the processes, or even lower layer in the stack, knowing when a connection has been dropped, how often it's being dropped, when it's being repaired by user, by segment, all of those analytics become really important. And then you've got it kind of creates a different problem, right? So now you've got all this data coming in and most organizations don't have enough capacity to just deploy individuals to watch data. And so having the right tool sets that are driving, literally notifications to product management or maybe customer support, right? There's a variety of sort of signaling sort of opportunities that can indicate when something is going awry or off the rails, and then having the capacity, the operational capacity to pay attention to it and feed that back into your product operations is really important. And this is something that, again, I give somebody like Ben Foster a lot of credit for, making sure that product management didn't just stop at defining the feature in Figma and launching it, right? But actually making sure that the feature was deployed, having the impact that it should, and that we were monitoring the health of that feature going forward.
If we transition a bit to Whoop Live, I remember early on looking at videos of athletes with their heart rate on the screen. I think it was very interesting to understand the potential of this technology. And I remember many investors pointing out towards health data as content, which was a term that I heard a lot. I think that innovation was very interesting. I also don't see it lately. But can we speak about it? Like, how does this work? And what did help Whoop achieve?
Yeah. Yeah, Whoop Live is an interesting feature in that it's both technically really hard. I mean, think about if you're a golfer on a tee and Whoop is capturing heart rate, right? Or you're in CrossFit, going through a course and Whoop is capturing heart rate, or you're a NASCAR driver, right? And you're racing around a track. Like, the technical infrastructure and the challenges in terms of capturing heart rate, getting it off the device, getting it to a local networked infrastructure that then could be pushed to a broadcast television in near real time, so that, you know, you're seeing somebody's heart rate when it's happening. It's a very, like, that's a non-trivial problem. It's a problem that extends, I mean, you've got a lot of challenges to make heart rate accuracy work on the wrist itself, right? And we could talk about, like, what that means and why it's so hard through PPG sensors to get that right. But there's a whole set of challenges alone before you even get to Whoop Live and the consumption of heart rate and the distribution over a live broadcast TV. I mean, I probably can't talk a lot about the underlying technology and how that was solved, as that would be proprietary to Whoop, but I can say that there's a massive amount of infrastructure and technology and intellectual property that goes into making all that happen. I think the impact is really around engaging the audience in, like, a fundamentally new way. It's sort of like it's almost like a fourth dimension, right? Because now, not only do I get to see the output of the athlete, whether that's a shot on a golf course or, you know, NASCAR drivers racing around, you know, in sort of their place and their performance. But, like, actually, NASCAR is an interesting example, right? Like, if I'm sitting in the stands and I'm watching a NASCAR race or a Formula One race, like, the things that I'm seeing are, like, really exciting in terms of, like, what a race car race means. What I don't have any appreciation for is what the driver is going through or what that professional golfer is going through on a tee, right? Like, it's very difficult to, unless you've done it before, it's difficult to imagine physiologically what's the response that individual is going through. And so Whoop Live provided that kind of insight, right? And it's just a single metric. It's just heart rate. But to look at the heart rate of a NASCAR driver be over 130, 140 beats a minute is amazing, right? I mean, I can tell you that, like, as somebody who doesn't watch a lot of NASCAR, but somebody who does pay attention to high performance sports, like, those NASCAR drivers are athletes. And I wouldn't have described it that way before without having, like, that kind of insight through your group. And similarly, like, the conditions as a golfer, right? Like, it feels like a very calm game. I'm not a golfer. So I can only speak to it from, you know, a spectating point of view, but it seems like a game of, like, being calm, obviously, and in control. But internally, physiologically, right? Like, you're controlling some very important responses, some sympathetic responses, which is what Whoop is about. And then it's surfacing those responses in a very consumable way. So I think it's adding another dimension for the viewer in terms of what the athletes are going through. I look forward into other areas, like I own a high performance coaching company called Podium Coaching Group, and we are working with SuperTry, formerly Super League, which is the fastest growing segment within the triathlon market. It's really high end downtown racing, like high energy short course racing in like amazing venues like Toulouse, France, and London. And again, it's the same story. right? As a spectator, I get to see all this high intensity. I get to see the output of that high intensity in terms of placement, right? And athletes, you know, going in and out of the water, transitions, getting on the bike. But what if I could see that, you know, real-time power, right? Real-time heart rate. What if I could see like stress responses that we're not talking about today, right? It just adds another dimension to the performance aspects and what those athletes go through when they're you know performing at their highest level.
Yeah, I've been to one event of Super League, and I was looking at the triathletes running with their heart rate on the screen and their speed and all of that, and it was so fascinating because it was also giving me the idea that the sport is changing. Since you can see the other athlete in front of you, you can actually see their velocity, and it can become a different. Instead of looking at how you feel, you can look at how fast they are. You can look at how fast you are, and then calculate things as well. And I think this is going to change sports so much. Can we understand from your point, like, you join and 560 people are in Whoop? Did you have three teams that you are working together? And I'm guessing it's hyper growth mode in Whoop. How does this feel like? Like getting a lot of people in, a lot of people out? Like how are you witnessing things in terms of?
At the time that I joined Whoop, we were going through rapid expansion. This was all prior to COVID, in which Whoop, like a lot of companies, experienced some contraction, right? Really some slowdown. But prior to that, it was, you know, we would talk about as a product team that it was like being on a rocket ship. And that meant a lot of different things in terms of like, you know, how you plan, like how you will think about like how you're going to staff up while simultaneously designing new features for which you don't even have capacity for on the bench yet, aligned to your strategies that you know, your 3, 4, 5 year strategy. You've got a lot of things in motion there, right? And there's a lot of like, you know, really important soft aspects. Like, it's not like you can take a 20 person product team, lay down a plan to grow them to 40 or 50, and then expect that they're going to join and be, you know, contributing at the same level as somebody who's been a part of the team for the past 2 years, right? Like, there's an onboarding, there's a culture, there's a velocity, there's operational aspects that you know, these new team members have to come up to speed with. There's the product itself, right? There's like multiple dimensions that are kind of pushing against that velocity while you as a team are trying to grow to create more capacity to drive higher velocity. And all these things are happening with a company like Whoop, and I don't think it's unique to Whoop, right? Where you're at this like hockey stick inflection point. And so it adds a lot of stress to the system, no pun intended, right? Like you've got, it's at that point, it's not just about building product. It's actually about building a product team with the right, you know, who are all aligned on the same vision, who are all driving towards the same kinds of outcomes, the same kinds of impact. And so getting all of those pieces in place, it takes really strong leadership. It takes a lot of communication. To be honest, like, it doesn't always work either, right? Like, there's going to be missteps. There's going to be, you know, when you're growing that fast, maybe you bring on individuals who ultimately you decide aren't a good fit. And I think organizations need to be comfortable with recognizing that, you know, an interview process can only get you so far, right? And that you ultimately, for you, for your customers, and for the product manager, in this case, for the employee, right? You may need to course correct. Now, that may mean, you know, a deployment into a different part of the organization. Maybe there's just not a good fit at all, right? But those kinds of things that are easy to take for granted in a very large or stable organization all of a sudden become under a lot of pressure within a hyper growth organization.
Was it a similar experience when you joined Google?
Yeah, Google's fascinating. I mean, and on paper, you would think it would be the counterexample, right? Because here you've got an organization over 100,000 employees, large, kind of corporation, you'd expect perhaps there to be just more governance and more overhead. And of course, that's true at some level. One of the things that's unique about Google is the organization around product areas. So when I joined Google, I was part of Android, but within Android, I was within the Wear OS team. And the Wear OS team was about the same size as Whoop. You know, it was probably 300 to 400 employees, somewhere in that ballpark. You know, UX, engineering, product management, et cetera. And so the benefit that you get from that kind of organizational structure is you get to move at a velocity, you get to make decisions in an autonomous like nature that feel like as if you're part of a startup company. One of the big differences is, of course, you also have like the backing of a company like Google, which has not only a lot of resources, but a massive impact area, right? Like the surface area that you as a product manager are impacting isn't 100 users or 1,000 users or 100,000 users. It's hundreds of millions of users, right? So you get this like really interesting dynamic where you get aspects of the organization and behaviors of an organization where you can move quickly as if you're part of a startup, yet the potential is massive in terms of the impact area that's available to you. There are challenges too, right? Like it's not perfect. When you organize in that fashion, getting coordination across the product areas can be challenging, right? But really what that translates to is product managers who are able to storytell, able to build relationships across the organization, able to find common areas of impact with other product managers, right? Where we're syncing and aligning on long-term strategies and impact opportunities and really like creating the opportunity. And so you can drive that consensus, you can drive that collaboration across the product areas if you're willing to sort of like, you know, dig in against those opportunities.
How is Wear OS today? I believe there's been a lot of changes. Like I'm uncertain yet of what's happening, but I believe after the acquisition of Fitbit, I heard lately that there's going to be change into everything's going to be centralized around Google instead of Fitbit logins and so on. How is this internally and what's happening with Wear OS?
Yeah, I mean, Wear OS, I think, is on a great trajectory. I don't work for Google anymore. So I say this as an individual who is a Wear OS user. I've got a Pixel watch on here. I say it as somebody who is in the wearable space still. One of the big step function changes for Wear OS was Samsung's decision to sunset Tizen and get on the Wear OS platform, right? Like that to me was a critical juncture in the journey of Wear OS because it took what was, you know, the largest non-Apple ecosystem and made it available on Wear OS. And there's also great collaboration between Google and Samsung, which allows for, you know, innovations to happen within the Wear OS platform. There's also been a lot of investment around power, right? So if you pay attention to, you know, the developer forums, the blogs, other podcasts where individuals are talking about Wear OS, power has been a primary focus, not the only focus, but a key focus, and really moving like battery anxiety. And so as we see the chipset getting more performant, as we see, you know, more sophisticated utilization of, this gets a little bit technical, but of the MCU, which is a lower power processor. And that happens in a way in which we're not sacrificing user experience, then we're going to see step function changes in power utilization on Wear OS. I think Wear OS is in a great position, frankly. And I think it's good, right? I think like creating more choice within the marketplace, ultimately the users are going to win as a result of that. So I'm excited about where Wear OS is going. Obviously, the Fitbit acquisition was a big piece in terms of probably less so on the Wear OS space, but more around building in a highly integrated health and fitness set of capabilities on top of Wear OS and specifically for the Pixel line as we see it today. So I think that's where we're seeing most of the impact. Sleep tracking, activity tracking, passive monitoring of things like steps and HRV, a lot of the things that, you know, Apple's been doing for a while. Like this Fitbit has been a catalyst to getting Google in general, Pixel specifically, and Wear OS is a platform for Google on the front lines.
And I believe you worked in Android Health as well for a while. How did this start? Is this more of a Google's approach to get closer to what Apple is doing? Or what's the vision of the product?
Yeah, so prior to Android Health, which was a construct that didn't really exist prior to when I took over as the product lead, there were a number of different pieces that were feeding into conceptually what we recognize as Android Health today. So one of them was on the Wear OS platform are a set of APIs called Wear Health Services. And these are the APIs that if you're Strava, if you're MyFitnessPal, if you're Cardiogram, for example, you use these APIs to access the underlying sensor capabilities of that device through Wear OS, right? So GPS, for example, for like run tracking, if you're Strava. So within Wear Health Services, you have, runtime or real-time tracking of metrics. There's also a passive monitoring API. So for things like sleep tracking, steps, things that are happening in the background outside of the context of an activity. There's a third API as well for spot check. So maybe I want to do an ECG spot check or a respiratory rate spot check. So that's what Wear Health Services is solving for, right? It's that API access on the device, on the watch itself. But we also had Health Connect. And Health Connect is a platform for, think of it as like the database for the storage and retrieval of that health and fitness information. And they were in a different part of Android, not within Wear OS. And so one of the key opportunities that we saw was to really bring those two things together. And I'll give you a really quick example of like why that mattered. When we talk about a metric, a physiological metric like VO2 max, well, VO2 max, you could think about that purely from the perspective of Wear OS and in even more specifically Wear Health Services like I just talked about, right? And so I could use things like maybe I'm getting running power, running pace, and running heart rate from my watch, and I can use that to calculate VO2 max. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Your Garmin watch will do that. As you use something like a Garmin Forerunner, it uses those similar kinds of inputs to come up with the VO2 max. But what about everything else that I'm doing that maybe is off of this Pixel watch, right? Maybe I went for a swim with my Whoop, which is capturing, you know, strain in the form of heart rate. And that strain could be a contributor to a VO2 max calculation. What I'm saying there is that VO2 max really is not an attribute of a workout. It's a physiological attribute of the individual, right? And so if you shift the problem from it being a Wear OS or Wear Health Services problem to a Health Connect problem, you can come up with a more robust calculation of VO2 max because Health Connect may see all of the sensors in your life, all of the different inputs, all of the devices and the apps that you're using can contribute to a VO2 max estimate for you as opposed to a single device or a single modality. That's a very nuanced conversation, right? But by bringing those Health Connect and Wear Health Services under a common umbrella called Android Health, it really just gives us the opportunity, right? And in some ways, the obligation to ask those kinds of questions and to make sure that we're thinking about, you know, algorithms and derivative metrics from that holistic perspective rather than a siloed point of view.
What does the database, like maybe what does the Health Connect enable Google do in comparison with the API that they couldn't do before from a business perspective?
Yeah, so think of Health Connect like HealthKit, right? So if you think of Apple HealthKit, there's really two key components. You've got the API for accessing sensors or algorithms, you know, on device, and HealthKit as a storage and retrieval mechanism for the user's health and fitness data. Similarly, on the Google side, if you were to combine Wear Health Services with Health Connect, you would get an equivalent, roughly speaking, of Apple HealthKit, right? Meaning you get the runtime access through the APIs and you get the storage or the database capabilities for health and fitness data. So it's not that, you know, Health Connect didn't sort of change the runtime API approach per se, but by putting these two things closer together, we could talk about what that means technically, right? Like, there's a deployment sort of, you know, concept where those two platforms are able to talk directly to each other. And there's all kinds of really positive implications when that happens from like a trust and a privacy perspective, from a user point of view. But that aside for a moment, Health Connect is really solving a very different problem than the runtime APIs. Now, once the data is in Health Connect, now users are in full control over which apps have access to it, who can read and who can write that health and fitness data, right? And so this becomes and in fact, going into Android 15, you will see more expression around the user's control over how that data is shared through Health Connect.
Very interesting. And when you joined for that role, how many people did you work with in the team? And like, is the team expanding these days, or what's happening there?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, Google, just taking your questions kind of in reverse, Google, like a lot of tech companies, has shifted priorities over the past 12 months. There's been pressure within the tech space, specifically. And I left in August, so I can't really speak to kind of the arrangement of those teams today. I can say that, and we can see this just from being on the outside, that health and fitness is an important component of what, Google is focused on. Classically Google, there's a variety of layers that go into that, right? Google Health, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Google Health is very different than Android Health, is also a key focus area for Google, right? And that's largely around the build out and deployment of large language models, AI in general, to support, more clinical and medical use cases, which is really important, right? Now, if you and I were to walk down the hallways of Google, you would see, for example, you would see an interaction between clinical perspectives that are supporting Google Health and clinical perspectives that are supporting Android Health. So I certainly don't mean to say that they're completely disjoint, but they are solving at some level different problems. Like I said before, like Wear OS was at the time when I was there, 300-400, employees, somewhere in that ballpark. Health Connect is a much smaller team. It's really a subset that was in Android. So that gives you kind of like a rough sizing as to like how big the teams are. But again, like I can say, like that as a focus area is strategically important to Google.
Yeah. John, I want to ask you something you might not know. I don't know how involved were you into this, but I've seen Android Health folks in many events around the US. So for example, it was in Health and Vibe and many of these events. Like, do these things work from your perspective and your understanding?
Yeah, I think they do. Health, as one example, right, it's an opportunity for Google to express, where they are from a capabilities perspective, where they're going from a strategy and a roadmap point of view. And I think that's really important for the ecosystem to understand, right? Whether you're a hardware OEM or whether you're a third-party developer like a Strava or MyFitnessPal, AllTrails, Peloton, right? Like, you want to be able to understand the direction and the strategy that's being executed by Google. And so these become events that allow for that expression to happen. Now, that's not the only way, of course, right? There's a variety of tactics through things like developer relations and business development conversations where those things are expressed and and frankly, a lot more detail. But yeah, I think there's value there. I think the other value is kind of going back to what we're talking about, right? Is expressing, you know, Google in this particular case, you know, expressing themselves as a thought leader in this space. And I think that like that gets, there's like a trickle down effect or like a ripple effect where eventually that bleeds out to the developer ecosystem, it gets to users, right? And it builds up this momentum around again, in this case, Google's focus on health and fitness and the investment that they're making and the outcomes that they're driving to. So yeah, I think it's really worthwhile. I think that there's probably a third, sort of benefit. It's not like the thing that is directly in focus when preparing for these events, but like it forces sort of a coordination and a rethinking around things like vision and strategy, right? Like internally, again, like if we bring this back to a product management point of view, it forces that recalibration around what your vision is and the kinds of, the kind of impact that you want to have within the ecosystem or within the users that you're targeting. And I think that's good, right? Like there's other ways to do that, of course, but that like sharpening of focus, yields a lot of benefits for product teams.
So for the last few questions, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions on sensors. I think there is, usually there is the two extremes. It's either there are going to be more sensors in more, like in your shirt, in your shoes, in your watch, in everything that you use, or there's going to be one sensor that overrules them all. Like from your experience, what do you think is happening?
Yeah, I love that question. I mean, there's really no question in my mind that the world we live in today and certainly the world we're going to be living in going forward is going to be one where there's more sensors, not less sensors. I do not believe in a world in which there's going to be a single device that's going to be able to capture everything all the time. So very specifically, like look at where we are today with, all right, here's an example. I mean, I sit here today with you with a Pixel watch on, which is capturing my resting heart rate. If I had a Pixel 2, it'd be capturing my body response as a stress measurement, as a result of doing this podcast, right? Like I'm getting all these metrics passively and I'm getting similar metrics on my Whoop as well, right? I'm getting resting heart rate. There's a stress feature within Whoop now as well, right? But so there are areas where there's overlap between two devices. And that creates a different opportunity, which we can talk about in a moment. But there's certainly areas where there's not overlap. So prior to this podcast, I went out for a run. And I can run with my Pixel watch because it has GPS and I can either use Fitbit to track my run. I can use Strava, whatever app I want to use. I get a visual display of my run. I can see my heart rate, my pace. I can see which zone I'm in. Obviously, I don't get anything like that from Whoop. There's no display, there's no GPS, right? So from an activity tracking perspective, I have a tool here that solves a very specific problem for me. But I could say, like, I'm not that interested for me, and this is a very personal decision, I don't sleep with my Pixel watch on, right? There's a variety of reasons for that. One of them today is power, which all of the, most wearable devices have, like, the challenge of having beyond 24-hour battery life. But Whoop very specifically solves that problem by allowing me not only to have, a charge for 3, 4, 5 days, but I can charge this device without taking the Whoop off my wrist, right? So like those things which maybe feel a little bit nuanced are critically important, right? Because like every time I don't have to take the watch off, I don't have to make the decision to put the device back on again. So, and like, I'm sure we see this with like, smart ring users. Right. If we were to look at Oura Ring or, there's a lot of rings coming to the market from Samsung, Zepp Health is launching one, right? We're very likely going to see users with smart rings in that example, along with a smart watch. And the same kind of sort of Venn diagram of overlap and disjointedness of health and fitness metrics is going to exist. But we could keep going with that, right? Look at the Sennheiser earbuds that were just launched, which, can now track temperature and heart rate through the ear canal. This is, right, now I could be on a run and I could be getting heart rate from my Whoop, heart rate from my Pixel Watch, and heart rate from my smart buds, right? This creates another opportunity for the wearable space, which is something that I think about around sensor fusion. I think sensor fusion is more than just sensor prioritization, which is kind of where things stop today. And that is looking at where is the most robust signal coming from which device and under which context, and then using that data as the primary source. And today that really doesn't happen, right? Like, I'd argue sensor fusion is barely dealt with, not at the level that I think we're talking about today. So I see both more sensors coming into play where it's more specialized. By the way, we haven't even talked about things like e-skin technology, right? Like, there's some really interesting research out of Caltech from Wei Gao around e-skin technology using galvanic skin sensors to emit sweat responses that then opens up a whole new like bio-wearable space. Abbott Laboratories is in this, right, with metabolites like lactate and ketones, obviously glucose. So as the sensors become more specialized, we'll see more devices within our environment sensing us. And then the challenge gets pushed down the road to how do we deal with all this additional data, and how do we merge it or fuse it in a way that is the most reliable, most robust, and most actionable from a user perspective. And I think that's the, I think if we get that right within a wearables perspective, like within our industry, then we can drive some very important outcomes for users, outcomes that we're not even talking about today.
John, for my last question, I wanted to ask if we go 100 years into the future and we look backwards, what are the three most impactful things that are happening right now that we would be looking, saying those three things defined the next 100 years of the evolutions of wearables?
That's a great question. Well, I'm going to repeat myself a little bit here, because I think this is going to represent a step function change. I think one is the new sensors and new algorithms, right? This is a key change that's happening today. And I think over the next 5 years within this horizon, we're going to see an explosion of new capabilities. And just to be really clear about that, like, we could be talking about fundamentally new sensors like e-skin, but we could also be talking about fundamentally new correlations. For example, like looking at the relationship between resting heart rate and HRV to predict if a woman is pregnant or when she's going to give birth, right? Here we have two fundamental metrics that have been around for a while, but now we've been able to drive a new insight by correlating them in fundamentally new ways. So I think that's one area. I think the other is our entire environment, whether it's on body or off body, is going to become more sensed. I could use my Pixel 8 Pro today to take my core body temperature. I think earbuds are going to get smarter. I think ambient sensing is going to be more prolific, whether it's stress response, sleep monitoring. I think the world we're living in is going to become more sensed. And again, that is going to push on the third important component, which is around sensor fusion. So as we amass more data and new kinds of data sets, how are we going to leverage those insights to drive outcomes? Now, those three things that I talked about, those are kind of like the plumbing of health and fitness, right? Like, these aren't the things that I think users are going to be like worrying about and thinking about, but I think that they are fundamental and foundational to driving. And I'm going to steal something from somebody who I admire a lot, Peter Attia, who talks a lot about, and actually in his book Outlive, talks about a shift from medicine 2.0 to medicine 3.0. And, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about what that means, but like, some of what that will look like will be a shift from population-based medicine to personal medicine, or reactive medicine to proactive medicine, or clinical kind of responses, right? And I think if we get these three things right, I trust we will, those will become important contributors to this shift from medicine 2.0 to 3.0. And I think in 100 years, we will look back at this shift as being one of the most important changes in terms of how we think about and how we manage healthcare.
Fascinating insights, John. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the time.